Welcome to another episode of Out of the Woodwork podcast, brought to you by Axminster Tools with me, Sean Eveley. This week, I'll be speaking to a furniture making legend, John Makepeace, about his illustrious career in furniture craft and design. His work has taken him around the world, working for numerous notable clients as a design consultant and producing a wealth of high-end furniture. Not only that, John has set up and ran his own college for 25 years. Now amalgamated in the Architectural Association, there is no stopping him anytime soon as he continues to practice and take commissions from his historic home in Dorset, which he shares with his wife, Jenny. So John, thank you for joining me. It's an honour speaking with you today.
Well, it's fun being here.
You're such a well-known maker and have made some fantastic pieces, but a lot of people might not know about how you got started and why you chose the direction of woodworking. Can you tell us about the early days and what inspired you to start woodworking?
We had two or three pieces of furniture in the house at home, which really spoke to me, and there was very little said about them. And then just one day, somebody said, oh, those are made by grandfather.
Oh, really?
And it was so, he died such a long time before that, you know, I never knew him and I hadn't made the connection, but I could certainly tell that these things were special. Yeah. And that must have made an impact. And the other thing was that materials were quite hard to come by after the war. I was born just in the first year of the World War II, so 39. By 45, getting timber was very difficult. So offcuts from the carpenter who came to repair our house after the war. His offcuts were wonderful for me. At 11, I saw really fine furniture making, a man called Hugh Birkett, and my mother took me there when she was going to talk to him about possibly commissioning a table, as my father was leaving one of his posts, and they wanted to give him a present, and this was a possible thing that they might have chosen. Yeah. Anyway, it was that didn't work, but the furniture that we saw on that day was again another mark at 11. And, you know, I really do believe young people learn so much about the world in their, you know, 6 to 12. And we seem to think that people are making career choices in their teenage years.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't think that's where the foundation lies. It can be much further back.
I agree.
If people have a breadth of experience, and that's what's so important that parents do for their children, is give them a broader experience of everything that there is in the world.
So you obviously knew you had an interest in the craft. And when you were a teenager, you went to Copenhagen to visit the master craftsman cabinet makers. Was that your... Did you decide to go on your own, or was that a school trip?
No. A friend and I and our parents thought it would be a good idea if we set off. And we did that a couple of years running. And Den Permanente in Copenhagen was a showroom. And each year they'd have a competition between cabinet makers for the best piece of furniture that year. Yeah. And it was all a national event, and it was terribly secret until the actual day of the announcement. And, you know, that was, you know, so thrilling that that culture cared enough about furniture,
yeah,
to have this national event.
So was it after that you realised this is something you wanted to do forever? Were you really inspired by the work you saw and the craftsmen?
No, I think I was still heading for university at that stage, partially because my father really wanted me to go to university.
What did you study?
I didn't go.
Oh, you said no?
Yeah, I mean, rather ironic, really. He actually died in my last year at school.
Okay.
And I suddenly felt I can make the decision I want to make now. And I just wonder how many people are fulfilling their parents' ambitions rather than their own.
So where did you decide to train in the end?
It was a real struggle. I went to Gordon Russell's and they said to me, you know, you want an apprenticeship. And that they knew that I really wanted to run my own business. And it was very, very hard to find anywhere. I finished up going to a man called Keith Cooper, Litchin Travers in Dorset. And the thing he said to me that he was most concerned about is just, don't expect to make a living. So why don't you train to be a teacher, which you can do by a distance learning course in your spare time and weekends, and then when you fail as a furniture maker, you'll have that as a fallback. And I did it.
Yeah.
And actually what was so good was that learning to teach design and making brought me into contact with all the books and the philosophy and the roots of the arts and crafts movement and the philosophy of design.
Yeah. So the sad thing is you education is so important and passing on the knowledge. But now in a lot of schools, the creative subjects and the design technology is being taken out of the curriculum. And I feel that you've still got the further education courses like Ryko Wood and the Building Crafts College. But if you haven't got the courses in the school, how do they know it's an option? What do you think that can be done to encourage the young people to start making again and know that it's an option?
It's interesting. It's something which the Victorian Museum is particularly addressing.
Yeah.
And thankfully, Tristram Hunt, the director, recognises that people need contact with materials at an early age to discover any kind of sensitivity and enthusiasm for that. There's an exhibition opened within the furniture galleries, which is part of the event I'm supporting, which is a collection of fresh new things made particularly from coppice and small material. And there it is in these galleries of fantastic historical furniture. But there's all this fresh wood as a central feature, and a film about forestry and about design and making. And so it's, how many children can we get to go to the V&A? That would be wonderful to see them in there.
Well, they have a fantastic furniture gallery in the V&A that I visited a few times. You mentioned that the live wood. You're an advocate for using British timber. Can you tell us why it's so important to use locally sourced timber?
Well, I think I'd start by saying we all love seeing trees in our landscape. How much more we enjoy those parts of towns and villages where there are trees.
Yeah.
People are naturally drawn to those areas. And as soon as there are no trees, you think, oh, this is a developer land. And no thought of planting trees carefully so as to become part of that landscape. So that, I think just trees themselves are valuable to our well-being. Apart from the fact they, of course, generate oxygen and many other things. Yes, so apart from the landscape aspect, if we don't use the trees we grow, then, of course, there's no means of supporting them. Trees, like any crop, need to be looked after. The seed selection and the silviculture of drawing those trees up to become like a cathedral columns, and it's something fantastic. And, so much woodland is just chaos. It's just abandoned. And sadly, some of major organisations in this country don't regard forestry as about creating a crop as well as providing the habitat, wildlife, and the social and other economic benefits. So it's important to use our timber because some of our woods are the best in the world.
Yeah. There's a misunderstanding that cutting trees down is bad, but it can encourage new life in the woodlands and new plants start to grow and more light is being brought down to, floor bed. But, the crazy statistic that 80% of our used timber is imported, but we do have enough wood here to use for furniture making.
Yes, there's a mismatch. From the 18th century, when, of course, we were using a lot of our so-called forests, which had been quite low-grade forests, for fuel for the Industrial Revolution. And as a result, we started importing then, and our trades tended to move to the ports where the timber was coming in. And so the well-managed forests that were part of the major estates and have been for centuries were then isolated from the manufacturing. And one of the most desirable things is to get manufacturing taking place where timber is being grown. So there's a natural relationship between the forester and his end customer, the manufacturer. And since that time, really, there's been a mismatch between forestry and the market. And so little pockets of timber are sold here to there to everywhere, and they're transported significant distances. Well, it's so much better if the whole crop, which, of course, at early stages, there's a lot of small timber comes out of a crop, which could be a local industry in itself.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's the final crop, which is highly valuable and may well travel further afield because it's so valuable. But forestry needs that interchange, and without it, it's economically quite tricky. So we really want makers to be thinking about what are the local crops, what's available. And one of the interesting things about these new exhibits of the V&A, they've all been made from small timber, and they have a freshness. So in these galleries of very historic pieces, they're this fresh ash, a collection of modern furniture in the middle of a walnut.
I think people need to see it as like a vegetable patch in the garden is right next to the kitchen.
you know, so you don't have that transport cost. I think if people thought the same way with furniture making and using local timber, then going to help the environment as well. We got some beautiful looking timber as well. Some of the best woods in the world are in this country.
Yes. I suppose one would encourage people to think longer term too. We tend to want timber immediately that's dry and ready to use.
Yeah.
If we could develop thinking that timber, like wine, even beer, needs a while become its best. And so if one can plan to have a stock of timber for one's future projects and just maybe buy what you need immediately, but then put a stock in of something that you could be planning for in the future.
So was that the philosophy of Hook Park that I know you're associated with building those amazing structures there? That is, there's a workshop right in the woodland.
Yes, I mean, Hook was really interesting. It's a fairly typical in the sense that it was 50% conifer, 50% hardwood, both beech and oak particularly, and some ash. But the conifer crops were the ones that were most neglected. And when the crops are neglected, they grow taller and taller and taller until the point they're inclined to fall over. Well, that was the threat for quite a lot of the conifer stands. And it struck me that there was this material which was from, say, 5 centimetres diameter upwards, which is really quite substantial. How could we use this timber better in developing a new campus and as a major material? And one of the intriguing things to me, when I talked with Fry Otter, who was the architect and engineer we wanted to involve about thinnings, he said, well, of course, what their very best property is their strength in tension. And I suppose I'd compare that with pulling a matchstick apart lengthwise. You know, it's so strong, we can't do it. And yet we can so easily snap it between our thumb and first finger. And so we're using timber's worst property most commonly. I mean, isn't that ironic?
I've seen some of the pictures of these structures that all the beams are in tension.
Well, that's the third component. When you take a stick that's flexible and you bend it, it becomes stiff. Now, that means that these trees, which were, as I say, down to 5 centimetre diameter, are bent over an arch. They form a very strong arch, and you can then make a lattice that becomes like an eggshell. So it's what's known as lightweight structures, using science as opposed to purely our tradition way of taking a big tree and cutting it into little bits.
Yeah. Not only is it a good use of the timber, it is incredible to look at because buildings aren't made like that, you know, and I think more should be.
Well, it's certainly material of the place because we built that site entirely out of timber that was needing to be taken out of the woods to improve them. And they take several forms. You would imagine some in an arched form. In another case, we've used their tension and they're a sagging form. So there's a ridge and the timber's hung from the ridge down to the eaves. And that curvature, again, becomes three-dimensional so that it doesn't flap in the wind because with wind, of course, not any pressure, it's suction.
Yes.
That's why the roofs lift off in gales.
Yeah. So why was Hook Park created?
At Parnham, we taught people to make very fine one-off things. And it struck me that it was enough, as it were. Yeah. And really what I wanted to see come out of Hook was this sense of closer integration between forestry and the making of things, buildings and products. And whilst I was directing it, that was where we had a quite clear goal for that. I retired at what stage? In 2001 and handed over to a new director. And they didn't take that forward. But what has gone forward is through collaboration with the Architectural Association, Hook is now their out-of-London base. So one's trying to get a generation of architects to actually understand forestry and timber in a way that's not just facades and cladding.
Yeah, and there's a workshop there. What's predominantly the work done in the location?
They build buildings. So they run a programme called Design and Build, and groups of students, 3, 4, 5 students, work on one project and produce a building. The biggest of those so far is a new workshop. What was important for them was to be able to get access with a forklift truck, getting into a building to make components. So it's big enough to make building components inside and then move them to another location on the site.
And do you have a sawmill on site that you can teach the drying process? And
there is a portable sawmill, yes. Of course, what's changed a little bit over time is that the crop has matured, so there are fewer thinnings at this stage. And one of the things they've done most recently is to take trees that were forked and used analysing those forks digitally.
Yeah.
And designing those forks into a structure. So forming a compression structure, which of course then becomes a bridge over yeah. which you can put a roof.
Yeah, I guess, you know, the cross section of a tree, you wouldn't need to add a joint then if it's just a branch coming off in that direction.
All the joints were then cut by robot because yeah. digitally you could control what each joint, where it needed to be and what form it might take.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to cover on that technology, actually, because when you first started, obviously, I can imagine it's very traditional. And then CNC started coming about. What was that stage in your career? Were you hesitant to involve the use of digital fabrication in work at the beginning? Or did you realize this is fantastic technology and you wanted to incorporate in your work?
At Hook, we were working with very eminent structural engineers and architects.
Yeah.
And so, yes, digital technology was an integral part for them. At that stage, the issues were, if you bend timber, how do you join it where it's really at the top? If you're wanting to create a continuous length of timber longer than the tree is, how do you join that? If you're pulling on timber, how do you get hold of it on an end joint that yeah. is as strong as the timber?
Yes.
Fascinating. And a combination of a steel pin, epoxy resin, but only 5% epoxy resin, 95% wood dust.
Okay.
Within that joint.
So I know some of your furniture in some of the legs joined into the seat with threaded bolts with epoxy.
Yep. I mean, what was thrilling was to be working with engineers and technology developed with Imperial College and three or four universities across Europe, and then to be able to bring that and apply it to the furniture, because it's made things possible that just couldn't be done before.
Yeah. It's amazing that we're still thinking of new ways of doing things, because it always was, you know, tenons, but you're now discovering threaded bolts, what you can do, and it's a much stronger joint.
Yes, this is all to do with complementary materials. You know, wood isn't good at everything.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things that the purists seem to think you've got to do everything in wood.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not the best use of our resources. There are complementary materials, is that sense of understanding what is needed in a particular location. It's fundamental to design, really. Yeah. I mean, we can produce a chair with three legs and in a very simple one seat and one back. And that's possible because we're getting high performance from the materials we're using.
Yes. And you started to incorporate cast bronze in your work.
Yes, in a very rather different vein. I mean, that's quite a decorative element, but I find it hugely complementary to certain woods. Yeah. I mean, mulberry, which is an absolute favourite wood. And that and bronze, whether it's brightly polished or whether it's weathered and patinated. Hmm.
So do you bring specialists into your workshop and you collaborate with them, people who are specialists in different fields like cast bronze?
Yes, we make the patterns and then we work the foundry. They tell us how much bigger the patterns have got to be than the parts we want because there's some shrinkage involved. Yes. And then I'd also work with structural engineers sometimes on some of the big tables we make, because there's three legs supporting a vast tabletop. There are quite a lot of stresses in that. And sometimes the piece has to be assembled on site when it's delivered finally in Hong Kong or Nairobi or wherever it's going.
So with your pieces, you are now focusing more on the design element and you have a team of skilled makers who can bring your ideas to life?
I have a small team, yes.
Yeah. Did you used to be more into the making, or was it always design at the forefront?
I was making quite obsessively until 1976, which is when we moved from Warwickshire to Dorset, to Farnham. And in moving to Dorset, we were setting up in a historic house, both a school and my own studios with 10 staff and a house open to the public. And so it's no longer feasible for me to have the scope for concentration on making in the way that I'd enjoyed previously.
Are a lot of the pieces you make now your ideas, your designs, or do you sometimes work with a client and they give you a brief and you try and fit that, or is it purely what you want to make?
It's pretty much what I want to make, really.
Yeah. That sounds like the dream.
Well, I think it takes a while. You know, I can remember some early commissions where people were terribly tight on budget, and at the end of the day, they weren't happy. And gradually, I suppose actually one of the stages I should talk about was that quite early on, when I was trying to think, well, who are my customers? And there were the general public out there.
Yeah.
And they weren't really thinking about it, and I could exhibit, and that might prompt one or two people. But it was shops that had to buy in order to sell. And so I created a small range of products, a low table and some woodware and a chair. And so now I got a target. I could walk into Heels, I could carry in a piece of furniture and put it down on the floor, and they'd say, oh, come into my office. And, you know, I'd walk out with an order for initially 6 and 12 and then 20 and 60. And so numbers just grew huge. Yeah. Too much for us to cope with, really. But what was important was one was actually generating revenue for a small workshop that was continuous. And it got so big that in the end we had to manufacture elsewhere.
Do you have any advice for anyone who does want to get their work into galleries or shops?
Well, galleries, one thing, I mean, it always seems to me what we make as craftspeople is not what people actually want. Yeah. It's what we wanted. And we're not terribly good at actually trying to assess what people are really thinking. But some simple products into retail is an easier route, it seems to me, rather than the gallery. Just the design retailers are always looking for distinctive products.
Yes.
And if you have design ideas and they're well refined, reduced, minimized, cut back, improved, developed, until you've got something really manufacturable, but stunning, then retailers would be interested.
They would be interested, yeah. Mm. So you've made so many pieces, but is there something that you haven't tried yet that you want to, or an exciting project you've got coming up that you're worried about, or something challenging?
Yes. Well, it's interesting because you'd hardly believe it, but we've done a series of dining tables which have similar features, but each time they're a total new challenge.
Yeah.
Because they're different size, different shapes, probably different materials. I rather love that process. It's not very often that we get commissions for things like chests of drawers. I mean, they're very labour intensive, and the world seems to have moved so much towards built-in storage that chests of drawers aren't necessarily a part of people's necessities.
Yeah.
Whereas dining tables and chairs are something which, you know, no house you buy comes with its table and chairs.
Yeah.
Which is why I found it a wonderful subject. And you know, table and chairs can be a very... we're just working on a set of 18 chairs and 3 tables, tables that nest into one another, which we've been working on for 18 months, nearly 2 years.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very expensive project.
Yeah, well, looking at your work, there's a lot that goes into it, and you have the time... You know, it justifies it. I think a lot of people would be interested to find out about your designing process and where you find inspiration. And is it all sketched? Do you do any computer design yourself? Or?
I don't do any computer design, no. I probably should, but I really enjoy working with other people who are damn good at what they do. Yes, so my design process is one of, I really like to write down what it is we're trying to achieve. And, you know, very often, you might use the word table. Well, you know, to me now, I want to know what you're going to do at this table. So I try and turn nouns into verbs.
Okay.
What's the activity going to be?
Yes.
Is it going to be conversation? Is it going to be relaxing? Is it going to be, you know, what the series of whatever those activities are? And that then frees you from that preconception of what a table looks like.
Yeah.
Because you're responding to the human requirements for that activity. And I think that's one thing that I found very, very constructive. Particularly with storage furniture. I find people don't very well understand chairs, and many designers don't.
Yeah. And why is that?
Well, because they're more inclined to think about the form of the chair before they think of the form of the body.
And what a chair should look like.
Yes. What's more beautiful than the human frame?
Yeah.
That's a pretty glorious start
to
making something to support it.
Out of the Woodwork is brought to you by Axminster Tools. Nobody is more passionate or knowledgeable about woodworking than us. A market leader in mail order tools and the machinery industry, we offer a friendly and personal service to thousands of woodworkers all around the world. Whether you're a trade professional, business owner, education leader, amateur DIYer, or a hobby enthusiast, we share your passion. Discover more about Axminster Tools, visit www.axminstertools.com.
So looking at your work, I see there's a lot of nature and some organic shapes. Is that a style you've developed over time? Were you inspired by someone to incorporate leaves and branches in, you know, the chair backs?
Yeah, so a chair should inherently, in my mind, be an organic form, certainly in certain aspects. How you support it, it could be something different. But similarly, with a table, I mean, we've done a series of tables which have a sort of leaf form, and I love that sense of a leaf rising from a leg, and actually having legs otherwise which disappear, as it were. So you almost get this leaf floating.
Yeah.
In cabinets, less so, although that flow series with the sort of wave form. It has organic feel to it, I suppose. And that was very interesting to me, doing that series, in that making a cabinet. You know, many of us will spend our time and our efforts producing the most beautifully flat surface. Then you think, well, here, there's this beautiful ripple ash. What happens if I carve into it and I get sculpted into it? Well, suddenly the thing becomes so much more interesting. And so that sort of fetish over producing perfection of flatness, which I want inside because of the draw movement and so on, but it doesn't have to be outside.
Yes.
It can be more expressive. And I think that's one of the things that I think craftspeople have tended to do, is they've become very mechanical in producing, you know, beautiful joints, but actually where's the joy? You know, what's going to communicate this to other people? And that, to me, is what design is about. It's about communication. And frankly, beautiful craftsmanship doesn't necessarily convey that.
Yeah. I'm sure there's not an easy answer to this question, but all of your pieces, you know, are very unique and they each have their own style. For a maker out there who is struggling and wanting to design something unique, it seems like everything's been done. Do you have any tips on even the starting point of for sketching, on where they can go to try and come up with something unique?
Well, I think you've got to be prepared to throw away at least 10 ideas, maybe 100, and just keep sketching, really. But of course, we're all working within our bounds. And you know, my bands were the same as everybody else's bands to start with.
Yeah.
And one produced pretty dreary things.
Do you remember some of your early pieces?
Yes.
What were they?
Just making a chest of drawers and of the sheer amount of work that goes into that. You know, all you do is you spend a lot of time, as I was saying, trying to produce these beautifully flat surfaces.
Yeah.
Over time, you think, well, go hell. You know, let's go for something more interesting. And so it's a growth thing, really. You know, where you start isn't where you're going. It's the next step on. And that's really how life is, why life is so exciting.
So if someone is, not finding it difficult in the early stage, it's just if you keep pushing yourself, ideas will come and experience. Since I've started, I'm looking at my early pieces. I don't actually have my early pieces because my mum didn't like the look of them and chucked them away. I'm not sure if you still have your early pieces. I'm very happy with the things I'm making at the moment.
Have you found an expression that suits you, as it were?
Yeah, I'm asked a lot, what's your style? But I like to make different things. You know, I like to try new processes. People have told me that they've seen all my pieces and they can see the similarity. But when I look at them, I think they all look different because I do like the Japanese style in some. And I think depending on, I'm a big fan of bent lamination and I'm a fan of Hans J. Wegner, his work. He's one of my design inspirations. So I think if someone's looking at some of my furniture, they can see the similarities there. But yeah, I don't think I want to be tied down to a specific style because I'm always coming up with ideas of new things I want to try.
You talk of laminating, two-dimensional laminating.
Well, I've tried compound curves as well in free forms, which are very hard to do. But
that's the exciting bit.
Yes, well, I agree. And coming up with a design where you don't know how it's going to be made, I love trying to figure out how to do something that I haven't done before.
Yeah, I mean, I just think three-dimensional laminating has real industrial potential.
Yeah.
Because, again, the organic form, I mean, our needs are not parallel and rectilinear.
Yeah. So have you seen Joseph Walsh's bent lamination, his chairs, and what do you think about that style?
Well, we're quite close mates, really. And we've both been talking to the family at Chatsworth.
Yes.
He's actually made a set of chairs. I think he's done 24, all different. And I'm concerned that, you know, some of them aren't very comfortable, but, you know, they're all very beautiful.
Yeah.
And that's great. How wonderful that a patron is prepared to commission 24 different dining chairs for a room that is quite gorgeous.
Well, I'm jealous that you're good friends with him. I'd like to meet him one day because he's inspired some of my pieces as well. Well, I was quite lucky to sit on one of your chairs made out of bog oak in the Carpenter's Hall.
Right.
I have to say, when I sat on that, I thought it was the nicest made chair I've ever sat on. The finish you got on it, and just so tactile and so smooth.
Yes, I mean, I'm pleased with that chair, and we've gone on to do a sequel to it as a dining chair.
Yeah, I think I've seen those. The back's a bit low on those ones.
Yes, that's it. Yes, so that was an interesting development.
How many prototypes do you do before you get to a final design?
They're almost all on screen.
Oh, okay. Mm. And then the first one you make normally is the real thing.
Yep, we might do a mock-up. I mean, I very much like the idea of getting to a drawing for the client to see, and then actually making a mock-up of that, which may be just plywood or any materials to get that sort of form, and then sitting them in it. And we did that with a chair recently, and the couple commissioning it. And she's a very pretty, small actress, and he's a huge rugger player.
Okay.
And each of them sat in it, and they just both seem to grow, you know. That's just, and that was what I wanted to know, was whether it would work for them both.
Well, yeah, so many chairs seem to be suited for one type, one size. Yeah, that's incredible that you know, two completely different styles fit perfectly. So going back to the British hardwoods, what materials do you use, and because we have such a variety?
We do. And the thing I find most tantalising is that some woods are really quite rare. So things like mulberry that we mentioned, it is really hard to come by. But the first tree I had was from one of the Physic Garden in London. It was about this in diameter. And we made so many wonderful things out of that. But I've never managed to find more of it. Only in occasional trees blow down in gales. But it seems some of the most beautiful things are also the rarest. Some of the most common things are relatively uninteresting. So beech, for example, which has been used for good but not necessarily very interesting furniture,
yeah,
over a long period, it has a grain which, you know, doesn't have any great appeal. And then in between those two, you've got so many varieties. I mean, there's things like a wild cherry wood, which is a delightful wood. And, you know, we import cherry wood from America, but, oh, it's so boring by comparison with our English one.
Yeah.
There's sycamore, and, of course, particularly Ripple sycamore,
yeah,
which is often grain we associate with musical instruments and that wonderful timbre that it has. Oak, of course. And interestingly, I don't like oak just finished with a clear finish. I really adore it when it's scrubbed and bleached. So yeah, it's like the back stairs of a historic house, or but bleached oak has great properties. And then we also torch it.
I was going to say, I've seen some of your furniture sort of ebonized.
Yes, yeah. So scorching it. And actually that really pulls the grain out.
Yeah.
And so it takes on another texture. And when we make a seat of some of our chairs, we layer it, and then we carve through the layers, and then we scorch it, and you get all this pattern.
You can see the pattern, yeah.
It's really exciting. And then ash, which of course sadly is not going to be available for a long while.
Yeah, for the people that don't know about the ash dieback disease, can you talk about that and what's going to happen?
Well, ash has been one of the timbers that people have planted most commonly in the last 30 years. And a lot of the plants are of one kind. Many of them have been imported from Holland. And sadly, they've all suffered the same disease.
Yeah.
And they're just dying. And now there's an obligation to cut those trees down in order not to provide
the disease support, ones.
The diseased trees, yeah, down. Yes.
So do you think there's a way of keeping them alive?
No, there's major research into that, of course, too late, really.
Really? So we're not going to be using ash in the future?
No, I think the trees that have been rescued will be on the market for a while. Oak is suffering, and of course, climate change being a factor. So one of the things that may happen in our woodlands is that we may find ourselves introducing other species from warmer climates that may survive. But I've not come across any that are more beautiful than the trees which have grown here for aeons.
It's such a shame. Will people start to store it and it be worth a lot of money? It's going to be worth like gold if there's one piece of ash left. Someone's going to pay a lot of money for that.
It's a bit like that. Sadly, the raw materials never command the value that the finished work does. It doesn't become that inflated.
So what woods do you use most often in your furniture, or do you always change it up?
Well, just one other rare one. I mean, holly is a great favourite for me. And that, of course, because of its whiteness. It's almost, yeah, like an ivory. And a wonderful contrast, of course, because it's so white and so plain by comparison with almost any other wood. I still think, what else? And yew wood.
Yeah, that the grain of yew is incredible.
And so often difficult to find a clean trunk. And then, of course, bog oak, which being dug up still, which is black as, or charcoal to black. And so you've got this big range from holly to bog oak, all from within the UK. I suppose for most users, they don't know where to find timbers. And of course, there are sawmills which specialise in cutting British timber. They're widely scattered, but there's one in most regions.
And there's always sawmills in your area if you have a tree of your own, or you know someone who's going to tree cut down, because often it's just been cut up for firewood. But if you know someone going to tree cut down, you can ask for a portable sawmill to come to location or send it away and dry it yourself.
I think you're better placed than we are in Dorset.
Yeah.
There's more interest and more forestry, I suspect.
Yeah. So, John, you're sponsoring the Making Good project, Rethinking Materials Future, which is in the V&A. Can you tell us a bit more about that and the work you're doing?
Yes. I think after COP26, we're all very aware now that we are having an impact on the environment, almost whatever we do. And one of the exciting things would be to actually reinforce this use of renewable materials, particularly from our own areas. If we want trees, then we need to use them, give them value at the end of the day so that others can be planted. But the project Make Good, Rethinking Material Futures, is about understanding nature and how we can source things more sustainably in the long term. And this is not only timber, it's likely to include textiles, probably fungi, all sorts of other ways that nature can work with us. But the main focus is trees and timber. And that's where we started with the symposium this year. And we had a wonderful young designer and maker who's living in a coppice, has a coppice nearby, and he's making things to order for clients. And there may well be components which are still raw.
Yeah.
And then on this last occasion, we had Gabriel Hemery, who is director of the Silver Foundation in Oxfordshire, an organisation which is very much concerned with the management of woodlands, with the better use of timber, with encouraging small industries in timber, even workshops where people, starter workshops, where people can get going with their business before they set out independently. But most extraordinarily, they are also dealing with farmers across the country who have so little idea of how to look after woodland. Yeah. It's not part of their culture.
Yeah.
They think planting trees is a good idea, and indeed it is. But they don't know what a commitment it is to look after them for generations. Actually bringing those trees up clean and straight so they have some value rather than being firewood.
Yeah. What can be done about that? Is this project to educate the farmers and people around the issues?
Well, certainly in the case of Silver Foundation, yes, it is. But then we also had speakers from Kew talking about what are the essential rules for reforestation. And actually some of those relate particularly to understanding what's already there. What grows in this part of the world? What grows well? And if there are surviving species, then let's take a sign from those as to what to do for the future. But there are also those whole things of interface between woodlands and the community. How do we make woodlands work for every bit of the economy and the environment and the society around? And they're all possible.
And you believe that craftsmen themselves should consider themselves as a small industry, and if all the craftsmen work together, then they can make a difference, even though they might just be on their own in their workshop.
Yes, it could be individuals or hopefully those with such energy and ideas that they run a bigger business.
Yes.
Because that's better for all of us.
Well, John, it's been great talking to you. I've learned a lot and I'm sure our listeners have enjoyed it. So thank you for talking to me today.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Sean.
Join us again next time for another episode of Out of the Woodwork. For more episodes, to listen and subscribe, search for Out of the Woodwork on all major podcast sites, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. For more woodworking project guides, demos, tools, reviews, and more, visit www.axminstertools.com.